Morgan. All righty, well, good afternoon to the Zoom subscribers, the Patreon subscribers, and most of all to you, Lucy Commissar. What I'm going to do today with Lucy's supplemental, well, not supplemental, I'm going to supplement Lucy's expertise on matters financial. Now, she has written an article about something. Correct me if you think the term I'm about to use, Lucy, is incorrect. But you have written an article for your website, the Commissar Scoop, about the malfeasance directed at a Russian couple named the Starostenkos. And that malfeasance has been directed at them at a ground level from UBS in the Bahamas.
Now
And
let me correct one thing. Written for Inside Paradplatz, which is a daily financial publication run from Zurich by Lukas Hasek, who was twice voted Business Journalist of the Year. And Zurich is the center of the Swiss banking system, and Paradplatz, in fact, is the location. Think of it as Times Square, but it's the Times Square of the big banks, including UBS. So it was published there, and then it was also published on my website and a few other places.
very good. All right. Well, thank you. I actually first encountered it in the postal newsletter. Correct me if you think what I'm about to say is incorrect, Lucy. But what you have done is to chronicle what I would call systemic malfeasance, at least insofar as it affected the Starostenkos through UBS Bahamas. One of the things that I found perhaps literally intriguing was the question of why. And I think to your credit, you didn't really get into the why, but focused on the ground level malfeasance that characterized a decade plus of the Starostenko's dealings with UBS Bahamas.
Well, wait a minute. Why is because they make money. Crooks do it because they make money. That's the why.
Absolutely. But I guess what I'm really thinking is who are the crooks? Because normally, in that 2009, I did an interview with Sterling and Peggy Seabright for the radio show about their remarkable book, Gold Warriors. And they dealt at length with not only UBS, but many other banks, which had tremendous amounts of gold deposited in them that had been looted by the Japanese during World War II. One Japanese official estimated that in the Philippines alone, they had $100 billion worth of gold secreted, and it would take 100 years to get it out. That was 100 billion in 1945 dollars. Gold is worth a whole lot more now. But across the board shenanigans. Well, what really struck me when I read your article, Lucy, was the lack of institutional correction. I think most of it are what I was starting to say. Sterling Seagrave said that most people are not aware that the world is run by gangsters or banksters, as he put it, and that I think would more or less sum up what you said. But what is the power that is exercised to facilitate these crooked doings? I mean, one might think that the largest private financial institution in the world, UBS, would be more subject to the exigencies of the regulators. And instead, what we are seeing is something that I think most people really would not understand. I also want to give a mea culpa. I myself had never engaged in these kinds of financial maneuvers. And so my understanding of some of the particulars is very limited. I've basically just gone to work, collected my paycheck, pay my taxes. Now that I'm an old guy, collect Social Security and Medicare. But it really is amazing to me how the Starostenko's got stiff, to use a street term, at every level of their dealings with UBS in the Bahamas. And I'm going to start by reading a section here. From your article is titled "Evidence Global Bank UBS Stamped Clients in Fictitious Trades to U.S. Markets." It's by yourself, of course, Lucy Commissar, August 10th, 2024. Again, from Inside Parada Plots by Lucas, the publication edited by Lucas Hasig. And you write in the introduction, UBS is found guilty of felonies by Western governments numerous times. This case could be part of a UBS strategy of worldwide stock market corruption. Are regulators interested? And that, I think, was kind of what I was stabbing at. Then you write, Yuri and Irina Starostenko, capital Starostenko, Italian citizens living in the Bahamas, allege that UBS Bahamas defrauded them by promising to execute trades on their behalf in U.S. markets and taking their money, but never actually making the trades. And now this is part of the maneuvering, that's maybe not the best word, but I don't understand, so I'm going to ask you to detail this or clarify this for the audience. From June to September of 2013, the couple, again, Yuri and Irina Starostenko, placed 252 trade orders in the U.S. markets, but UBS failed to provide confirmations required by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission that the trades were executed. Now, I don't understand how something like this would work under normal conditions. Can you explain that to me and to us?
Yes, if you make a trade into the US, it goes to an institution such as the New York Stock Exchange or some other exchange which has the shares, and it buys buyers and sellers have to go through the New York Stock Exchange or whatever the exchange is that is dealing in the shares. Under the SEC rules, whoever is handling that, and it has to be an institution that is a member. Only members of the New York Stock Exchange can handle trades into the New York Stock Exchange. That institution has to send back a confirmation. Yes, we made the trade. We took this amount of money and we either bought or sold. If we took the money and then we sold the shares, or we sent the money because somebody else bought the shares, and we handled that. So you have to have a confirmation. In this case, they were dealing with a Bahamas subsidiary of UBS, which was not a member of the New York Stock Exchange. So it had to go through an institution in the US. But of course, UBS has a lot of institutions, including some in New York or and in about 200 in the US that handle these kinds of trades. So it should have been this UBS institution. UBS Financial Services handles trading. They should have gotten the and they're a member of the New York Stock Exchange, so they should have sent back to the Bahamas institution a confirmation of trade. They didn't do it, and these people tried for months and months to get the trade confirmation, and UBS refused to do that. And that's what persuaded them that these trades hadn't been made, because otherwise, why couldn't they get a confirmation of the trade?
You also indicate in your introduction, and again, I'm going to read directly one of the bullet points in your introduction. In 2018 to 2019, after litigation, and I'm assuming that is the litigation ostensibly to or intended to oblige UBS to pony up the appropriate documentation confirming that the investments had been made according to Hoyle. In 2018, 2019, after litigation, UBS provided internal documents purporting to show the trades, but they did not include required confirmations from U.S. brokers proving the trades occurred. And this is something of a spoiler alert to the audience, but eventually, after a tortuous and I think probably for the Sparrow-Stankos, a traumatic series of encounters with UBS, with their lawyers, etc., they did in fact get what might be termed the smoking documents or absence thereof, indications that in fact UBS had never made the trades that they claimed they had made, and yet still nothing was done. Yet another bullet point here. The couple alleges over $200,000 in losses from what they term fake trades. Can you tell us, Lucy, or synopsize for us how those losses would have been incurred and what UBS did? At one point, you described what UBS was doing as playing poker where only the dealer can see the cards, and that permits the dealer, in this case UBS, to cherry-pick whatever documentation they feel will best serve their aims, and their aims appear to be frankly crooked. Can you perhaps again encapsulate what UBS failed to do, what they should have done, and what that indicated about what the Sparrow-Stankos were trying to do?
When you make a trade through a company such as UBS, your local stockbroker, you making the trade is at a certain time, and you know what the price is at that time because the price of a share shifts. The confirmation from whoever handled it in this case in New York with New York Stock Exchange, it will also have the time the trade was made. If you don't send that information to the buyer, they may not know that you did not make it at the time when the price was X. Maybe they're going to wait a little later and the price is different. And if the price has gone down and you bought the shares at a higher price, they're going to keep the difference because you don't know. And so part of the money is that the trades were not made at the times that the traders thought they were being made. And this is, by the way, this happens. This is not an uncommon event that the UBS invented, but it's what a lot of corrupt brokers do. They don't trade at the time when the price is right for the customer. So that's one of the things. And one of the other points to be made is most retail traders lose money. The money is made by the big guys and the hedge funds and so on. So the theory here is if you're losing money, you don't get anything back from the stockbroker, right? Now suppose and they haven't made the trade, but if you've lost in the trade, if the records show, well, you bought it at this price and it's gone down, therefore you've lost money. So you're not going to get anything from them because you sent them the money, they take your money, and they say, look, you didn't make any money, so you can't, if you sell it now, you're going to have less. What they do is if you sell it, they take the money out of their pocket. So th they win in both ways because they never sent the money in for the trade. You're not, if you have lost the money, they will just take it out of the pocket. And if you paid them 10,000 for something and now it's worth 8,000, they may give you the 8,000, but they've already made 2,000, right? Because they never spent your full amount on buying the stock. So that's how that works.
Oh, and perhaps I'm parading my ignorance of these kinds of maneuvers, but that sounds to me like the inverse of short selling. Am I correct?
Of short selling? Well, it's not.
Well, that's the opposite of short selling. In other words,
Well,
they're
it's
basically.
not. It's not exactly, because in at least in short selling, you're supposed to borrow the share. The thieves don't do that, but they're supposed to actually borrow the share from whoever is holding it, it's another institution, and then they have to send the share to the buyer, and they hope the price will go down. So what they will do is buy it at a lower price, and they will make a profit on that. But these are real trades that go on. In naked short selling, they never send the share to the real buyer. But otherwise, these are real trades. And what we're talking about, the trades are never made.
One of the things I talked about the I use the concept systemic corruption. Your next bullet point, again, in the introduction to the article per se, UBS has won 10 years of delays in the Bahamas case to avoid a judgment on the merits. The dispute continues in the Bahamas courts, where judges' delays were condemned by a chief justice. In the latest, June 19th, the judge canceled a hearing that should have granted the Starostenkos a trial date. Throughout the course of your article documenting what the Starostenkos endured, one of the striking things to me was, again, perhaps I'm waxing overly conspiratorial or parading my ignorance or both, in which case I'll apologize. But what might be termed the hidden hand, some very powerful interests are working on behalf of UBS behind the scenes, getting judges appointed who either were within a few days of retirement age and were highly politicized, as one of the judges was. Another judge was a real estate agent, and ultimately UBS wound up confiscating the Starostenko's house, which they had put up as collateral. And the house had been estimated by properly vetted authorities to be all between three and a little under $4 million. I think UBS had 1 million. But what strikes me is how UBS or whatever interests on whose or with whom they're working were able to game. I mean, maybe this sounds, again, overly conspiratorial, but they were able to game the whole bloody system. I mean, it's, you know, people think, and for the record, 688, again, called Darkness in the Vault, I chronicle, that's available on the spitbriars.com website, the travails of people who attempted to redeem gold certificates or documents which would indicate that they had gold deposited in UBS and other institutions, Citibank or Citicorp. And yet, the system itself appears to be, if not actually criminal, certainly very close to it. And it's just amazing to me, Lucy, how UBS or the elements on whose behalf they're working.
Well, if you look at what's going on in the Bahamas, the UBS lawyers are Lennox Payton. They were the registered agent in the Bahamas for Bernie Madoff. Brian Sims, the principal partner, was chosen by the Securities Commission of the Bahamas to be the liquidator of FTX, the company of convicted fraudster Sam Bankman-Fried. Another partner of Lennox Payton sits on the board of that same Securities Commission, and it has authority over UBS's compliance with trading rules. So the ju then the judges for 10 years have violated the rules of Bahamas courts, which guarantee plaintiffs trials, and they have ref over 10 years they have postponed one after another for no reason, fake reasons, And these people have been refused the chance to have a trial on the merits. So from the evidence shows that the Securities Commission and the judicial system are very corrupt.
Profoundly so. I'm very glad that you brought up both the FTX slash Sam Bankman-Fried and Bernie Madoff. What is that not only indicates that the malfeasance here is not unique as applies to these individuals and institutions, but one of the questions that I have, Lucy, is how come these law firms and or individuals are allowed to keep operating despite the fact that they obviously were not, they were dishonest.
Well, they
And
have their own people on the places where that should be deciding that they shouldn't be operating. I mean, the whole system seems to be some kind of a mafia-like a web. They're all connected to each other, and there's a lot of money involved, and that's why, I would say that if I was in the Bahamas, a really well, I, if I was a trader, I would not have anything to do with the Bahamas. Because the system is corrupt. And this may be a warning to people to be careful, to be aware that I would not try. If there are people on the inside, and those are the locals. And then these people had come from the outside. So they are not part of the system. And that's why. What was interesting is that the Chief Justice at one point, actually, in a decision, which I linked to in my story, said that it was terrible and unacceptable that they had been that the trial had been delayed over and over, that they were not given a chance to have a trial. So even that person who was then the Chief Justice, he said that. So that's a real problem. There are people that recognize this, but the people in charge of the government and of the Securities and Exchange Commission are obviously and the courts are obviously dishonest because on the face of it, to me, they are dishonest because they are accepting documents as if they were trade compliance in compliance with the trading rules, but they're not because they're all the documents that were filed and provided to the court in this case by UBS were internal documents. Under the SEC rules, the SEC of the US, they have to have documents coming from the trading office of whatever institution made the trade in the US, not an internal document of UBS Bahamas. They were unable to provide it and they admitted they didn't have it. That should have been clear that that what was going on was serious corruption. But there's a There, so there is a problem there. How, what can you do in the whole, when the whole system is corrupt?
Well, indeed, indeed. And I'm glad you said that. When I say things like that, people say, oh, you think everything's a conspiracy, blah, 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 blah. there are some very brutally clear facts that would suggest that maybe not everything is a conspiracy. But certainly, all of us are not in Kansas anymore, Toto. The next two bullet points, the Starostenkos also sued UBS in U.S. court for securities fraud. UBS got the suit in the UBS, dis in the U.S., excuse me, dismissed on jurisdictional grounds, but the couple filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Good luck with that, given what the Supreme Court is composed of now. But the next bullet point, I think, really encapsulates your story, and meaning the story of the article, and really what is so important about it. The story raises the question of why UBS would pay millions of dollars over a decade to a well-connected law firm, a partner sits on the stock market regulator board, for a minor case brought by a day trading couple. Unless evidence brought to court would show a pattern of executing fake trades globally. One more time. Unless evidence brought to court would show a pattern of executing fake trades globally, harming massive numbers of investors and markets. You've been right. The next 4 point. Top UBS officials declined to comment on evidence that backs up these claims. And then you write financial regulators and prosecutors in the Bahamas, Switzerland, and the US have the authority to investigate whether fictitious trades were made by UBS Bahamas and if they exist elsewhere in the UBS system. So far, none has done anything. I would add to that one of the things that you chronicle in the latter part of your article, Lucy, which is that you were involved with some of the Zoom meetings that in which the Starostenkos were dealing with various UBS officials and or the lawyers that were working on their behalf, and yet they really would not allow you to participate. Perhaps this is a spoiler alert, or maybe I'm putting the cart before the horse in this instance. But it is to me very significant that as a truth teller, as someone who is chronicling these events, eventually to bring them to public attention, the powers that be were really quite firm in seeing to it that you could not participate in the Zoom meetings or really become involved in any of these machinations.
It wasn't to participate. It was just to view because these were court hearings, and the court has hearings on Zoom, and the various lawyers, the Starostenkos, the judges, they were not all necessarily in the same room. They were all on Zoom, and I was invited by the Starostenkos, but it was acceptable to just watch. I didn't speak. I just watched, and. Once they I and I watched a couple of them, and these were all about procedural motions when the Starostenko's still trying to get a hearing on the merits, never got them. But I watched this. But as soon as when the lawyers found out that I was a journalist, they demanded that I be knocked off, and the judge knocked me off and said I couldn't be on the Zoom call to I couldn't watch what was going on. So that is what has happened there. They really do not want journalists to see what is going on.
And I think that obviously is because journalists might alert the public to the fact that the institutions with whom they might be dealing and from whom they're expecting to make money are corrupt, and that in fact they may be getting robbed. One of the things you point out here with regard to UBS, and this is something I've covered in past programs. In 2008, U.S. Senate investigators reported how it used code names and encrypted computers to help hundreds of rich Americans evade multi-millions on taxes. Just a year later, UBS agreed to pay $1.56 billion to the U.S. for failing to report about 14,000 foreigners' trades of U.S. registered securities and paying the required withholding tax. Since then, UBS must report all trades in U.S. securities to the IRS. I would add, ha-ha. In 2012, the U.S. fined UBS $1.5 billion for manipulating LIBOR, capital LIBOR, and other benchmark interest rates. So obviously, UBS has been brought to heel by regulators in the past, and yet that doesn't appear to have really changed their direction. You also write here, and this is the essence of the case as I understand it. From 2013 to 2014, Yuri Starostenko feverishly placed over 200 stock trades on the U.S. markets. Under U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC rules, records should have contained trade confirmations from U.S. brokers. Proof the trades were executed as ordered on New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ. It should have come from UBS Financial Services, which handled the Bahamas orders. Instead, that never happened. Quote, "We never received a single confirmation," unquote, Irina Tsareva said. quote, despite endless requests, unquote. And again, it was the failure of UBS to provide that documentation that really might be said to be the pivot point of this entire case. Please correct me if I'm wrong, Lucy, because as I've indicated, an awful lot of this is past the point Greek to me, not having ever engaged in these kinds of financial transactions. Again, I'm just a working stiff who has collected this paycheck, paid his taxes. Now I've got my Social Security and Medicare, at least the Republicans take that away. But it is the failure of UBS to provide to the Starostenkos confirmation that the trades they thought they had executed in the US were actually made. Correct?
Anybody who makes, who's listening, anybody who makes trades in the stock market through a broker knows that they get a confirmation. This is not rocket science. And so to not get a confirmation, it's an automatic thing that goes out. If you're not getting confirmations and you protest you're not getting confirmations, you know something funny is going on because it is standard to get confirmations. And there are all the documents which I show and I have linked to files of the documents they did send. None of them were confirmations. I asked UBS in New York to show me a sample confirmation just so we know what it should look like. I wanted to compare it to what they did send, and they refused to do that. They, in fact, I sent them a draft of my story. They refused to comment except to say it was all wrong. I said, "Well, tell me what's wrong. I would love to write what you say and point out what you say is wrong." Of course, they didn't answer that because
Maybe
everything
what
is
I'm about to say,
documented.
maybe what I'm about to say is somewhat out of line, but near the end of your article, Lucy, you in that same context, you set forth a communication or communications that you have with a guy named Josh Humphreys the Third, who was shilling, I think it might be a term for UBS. What I was really struck by was the picture of this guy. I mean, if he doesn't look like a dyed in the wool, Jonathan Humphreys the Third, a dyed in the wool phonus balonus. I mean, what a nervous, almost criminal smile this guy has. And again, he said, "Well, if you would show me what yeah, this is the guy who asked that all of your communications be kept off the record." And you note that he really didn't have anything to say that was worthwhile. But going back to what perhaps might be subsumed under the term systemic corruption, you write, and in October 2013, meaning the UBS account manager cryptically claimed lawyers would need to approve providing confirmations. A violation of SEC rules that traders are entitled to them. Red flags snap in the tropical breeze. Why the stonewalling over standard documents? And then you, in the next paragraph, even more alarming, Kevin Price, an ironic last name, by the way, the head of UBS's Bahamas trading desk, had from 1994 to 1998 worked in the U.S. for fraudster Bernie Madoff, yet another evidentiary tributary leading in the direction of Bernie Madoff, who built his Ponzi scheme on phantom trades. Later in 2013, when Price worked for UBS Bahamas and handled the Starostenko's trades, he also worked for UBS Financial Services, which was supposed to send the confirmation. Now, I'm going to read one more paragraph, and then I want to jump to the, I think at least for the Starostenkos, perhaps being overly sensitive, but I think for anyone who is inclined to have any confidence in the system, the harrowing things they experienced, even having their family physically mugged, as far as that picture indicates, while their home was being confiscated. Skipping down, you write, UBS held a trump card, ironic use of the term there, The loan in which the banks lent them 1.4 million in exchange for collateral of their home was 2.8 million in 2012, according to the appraisers engaged by UBS. But the card was a joker. UBS, which was an offshore bank allowed to provide services for foreigners, had obtained a license from the central bank to give mortgages to foreigners for second homes. However, the loan for trading was made to the Starostenkos 8 months earlier, and they were permanent residents. The mortgage deal was not allowed by the bank's license. The UBS deal was a fake. And I know that in the past we had discussed Credit Suisse and the things have been going on there. I know you have not studied that, so you don't want to comment on that directly. But I do want to note, for the benefit of the audience, that the guy who was the CEO of UBS when this BS was going down, forgive my perhaps overly cute in injection there, but a guy named Sergio Ermotti, a very photogenic individual. He then became CEO of UBS again when they merged with Credit Suisse. So I think there is perhaps some indication that Sergio Ermotti was not operating with the cleanest of hands. Also underscoring yet another evidentiary tributary, and this is supplemental to something you've already said, Lucy. The Lennox Patent Law Firm, that's capital LENNOX, patent capital PATON. Lennox Patent is well connected. It was the registered agent in the Bahamas for Bernie Madoff, along with Kevin Price, yet another evidentiary tributary leading to Bernie Madoff. Brian Sims, the principal partner, was chosen by the Securities Commission of the Bahamas to be liquidator of FTX, the company of convicted fraudster Sam Bankman-Fried. Another partner, Michael Patton, sits on the board of the commission with authority over UBS's compliance with trading rules. And one of the things you point out, Lucy, is that as the Starostenkos worked to basically get their money back and to get UBS to do what they are required to do by law, things got physical, I guess one might say. You write of what happened to the Starostenkos home. Then on February 27, 2018, a team sent by UBS lawyers with no judicial order illegally forced the Starostenkos out of their home. And then you link to a video. Local authorities took no action against UBS. The family depended on friends to house them. They would become eligible for food vouchers. And you show one of the Starostenko's teenage sons, a fellow named Tio, capital TEO, being restrained, I mean, basically grabbed around the neck. This, I'm kind of struggling for words because this really, I can't say it nonplusses me, but people think that, well, this is nasty, and you may be getting basically jilted on paper, but that's all it is. Now, this has a very real physical and, from the indicator, violent component to it. The Starostenkos weren't just cheated. Perhaps you will disagree with the term I'm about to use, Lucy, but if so, use your own term. They and their family were physically mugged with regard to their home by UBS, as far as I can tell, with impunity. Can you develop that for us?
Well, that is true. The deal was that the money that they put up their house as collateral, but the money was supposed to half remain in the account and half be used for trading. But the point was, there was no evidence that there were any trades made. That was the contention. So they then went in and basically, because the courts are corrupt, took over the house with no evidence that the money that had been put in the account for trading had actually been used for trading. So they, it seems to me, they basically so far have been guilty of theft of a multi-million dollar home. They're trying to sell it. They haven't been able to do that yet. That's why it was interesting that one of the judges was a real estate agent, but never mentioned in court that she was a real estate agent. But she advertises on the internet, so it's easy to find her web page that she's a real estate agent. So not only are they did they steal the money that should have gone for real trades, but they have at the moment are in the process of stealing these people's home, and they have well now six kids. Nope, they live because of the kindness of the friends there. They really have no home of their own, and the kids have grown up this way for 10 years, which makes a big difference to we know about homelessness. This is not quite, this is next to homelessness. So this is the real problem. I think that it's really vicious. When I see the details of what they have done to this family, I think that their behavior has been vicious.
Well, vicious and clearly illegal, and yet, despite that, it has been endorsed by the powers that be. From your article again about one of the, forgive my term, perhaps funky judges who managed to get involved with this case, and that is Judge Ruth Bo Darville, capital Bowe dash Darville. And you quote Irina Tsareva of the Star Spangled here. We came to the September 2019 trial and it was canceled, unquote. Judge Bo Darville had accepted UBS's motion that they've had no witness and needed to postpone the trial. She set no future date. That sounds to me, Luciana, not sophisticated with regard to judicial matters. That the thing that they had no witness and needed to postpone the trial. That really sounds like the dog ate my homework, with regard to judicial matters. And she, the judge, set no future date, raising the corruption issue. A Bahamut critic wrote, quote, "Legal observers have opined that she, Bo Darville, was one of the most political judges on the bench, as the FNM appointed party supporters in an attempt to secure convictions in the prosecution of political opponents." And that you talk about her in the paragraph above. Raven said that UBS needed 6 weeks to get its own witnesses. Nevertheless, when more than 6 weeks later, the Star-Spangled arrived for the first day of the trial, September 23rd, 2019, they heard that it was just, quote, a housekeeping hearing, unquote. Judge Ruth Bo Darville, a new judge on the case, had been sworn in May 2019, just 3 days before she reached retirement age. There was widespread criticism of that appointment, questioning the independence of the Judicial and Legal Services Commission. Amen. And again, although you're not in a position to really answer the question definitively, Lucy, well, let me finish what you wrote. Yet the Prime Minister would extend her tenure for more than 2 years, enough to keep her on the UBS case. This really s sounds like UBS has the, well, the government of the UBS by the short hair, so to speak, that they are calling the shots. And the people at UBS, whether they are members of the judicial system or their financial regulatory apparatus, or perhaps even some of the political officials who are in charge of those domains, basically are answerable to the corruption that has become part of UBS, raising the question of something even more profound. And you also indicate, I'm trying to find the position of the other judge, one was a new thing, was Carla Card Stubbs, and you reproduce her formal marketing of her real estate status. And you point out that at one point, I can't find the exact quote. I will include it when I send you a written description for this. But at one point, Irina Tsareva said that basically she got the smoking gun. They got written confirmation that, in fact, the trades for which they had contracted were never made. And yet,
Wait a minute. No, it's not that they weren't got confirmation. What they got was an admission that there were no other documents about the trades. So therefore, the confirmation was did not exist.
okay, so there is no proof that the trades did not exist, but this is what I was looking for. Irina Tsareva felt vindicated. She said, quote, "This proves our worst fears. UBS likely never executed a single trade on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ," unquote. Then you write, "The scam would have worked like this. Clients place orders expecting execution on U.S. exchange." I should have perhaps introduced this at the beginning of the talk, but the bank never actually routes the trades while claiming otherwise. With no real-time confirmation, UBS could retroactively cherry-pick execution prices most detrimental to clients' accounts. The bank chooses claimed profits and losses. Compare it to playing poker, as I did mention, when only the dealer sees the cards, the house never loses. The victims are none the wiser until they demand those obscure confirmations. For the Starostenkos, the price of peeking behind the curtain was ruinous. The demand for full loan repayment years early and seizure of their home. What is the status of the case now, Lucy? Are the Starostenkos still basically, in effect, couch hopping? Are they still living on the grace of friends? Have they been able to secure the return of the house?
No, the situation is the same. And in fact, on Tuesday, there's another hearing, which I will try to watch if I don't get thrown off. But that they're trying to get the Privy Council in London to deal with this. They also need to get some actions taken by the courts in the Bahamas, and the courts in the Bahamas have prevented their ability to raise this with the Privy Council in London, because the Bahamas is part of the British legal system, so, to the extent that the final Supreme Court is the Privy Council, which sits in London. So that's the next thing, and that's happening on in a couple of days on October 1st, I guess it's would
The
that
day after tomorrow.
and therefore so I will see what happens, but I'm not very sanguine. And at this point, there would not be a decision then anyway. Usually, the decision comes after a hearing. But we will see. I will see what happens on that. They are still pressing ahead. The unfortunate thing is they have not gotten any support from the courts in the U.S. If the if what is happening is that UBS is scamming the system by violating SEC rules, should the UBS be allowed to participate in US stock markets when it is cheating customers and not giving them the confirmations? But the court, the federal court on the district level, interesting, the judge is part of a law firm that recently joined another law firm that is the UBS law firm. You know, there's so much of these things that cross, and people have connections. And then the lawyer for UBS in New York, ironically, said, "This is there's no jurisdiction because the trades were never made into the U.S." What? He's saying the trades were never made. He's admitting what they've been claiming, and he's saying that's why there's no jurisdiction. And this judge in the U.S. accepted the argument that there's no jurisdiction. Now they couldn't get anywhere with the appellate court, and now they are trying to get into the Supreme Court. But it's very difficult. You really have to have support. You have to have an amicus, or more than one amicus, of significant lawyers or institutions that are saying the Supreme Court has to look at this, and that has not happened. So one doesn't know where that will go, and that's why they're also trying the Privy Council in Europe. But that's so they're still in the court phase, but and they still have gotten no trial on the merits. Never has there been a trial saying UBS cheated us because they made these trades and refused to provide confirmations of trade, full stop. There has never been that because the court system in the Bahamas is corrupt. The court system in the US seems to be questionable. And don't know enough about the Privy Council, but they don't seem to think that it's so far, they don't seem to think that it's an issue for them. So it's very difficult for individuals to go up against an international legal system which is on the side of the big institutions.
Lucy, what is an amicus? Forgive my ignorance, but AMICUS.
Oh,
What is that?
it's a friend. It comes from amicus, friend, a friend of the court. In
Okay,
this
got
case,
it. Got it. Okay, very good.
it should be a friend of the plaintiff, huh? But it's a friend of the court putting in, we think this about this case. This is our view. This is what you should do. And it's
Okay,
quite
thank
common
you.
for the
Oh, well,
Supreme
so
Court. It's very
it's
common.
not like the same like ami, a friend. Okay, got it. Yes, very good. One of the things I want to call to the listeners' attention, and this again is not in your article, Lucy, but with regard to the Bahamas, that has in the past been a long-standing epicenter of corruption, fascism, maneuvering. One of the things that we have studied and or covered in past programs, and in For the Record, program 11467 and 8, I went into an article by the brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Bale Scott from Covert Action Quarterly from February of actually the winter of 1985, and it was called How Alan Bellis and the SS Preserved Each Other. And this was actually going to be part of a book that Peter Bale Scott was going to publish, but the professional headwinds were simply too strong, so he never published the book. I eventually transcribed the portions that he was unable to publish. And one of the focal points of that was the organization Resorts International, headed up by the late James Crosby. And that was an epicenter of, once again, institutional corruption in the Bahamas. One powerful element there was organized crime in the milieu of Meyer Lansky. And also, there were elements of intelligence community money and money from the post-World War II Nazi diaspora, both personal and financial. And again, the institution that was the overall umbrella for that was Resorts International by James Crosby, and specifically looking at the Paradise Island Bridge Company. But eventually, when James Crosby, quote, died unexpectedly, unquote, this was on the eve of the Iran-Contra scandal, Resorts International was purchased. One part was broken into two parts. One part was bought by Merv Griffin, the TV talk show host. The other part was bought by, drumroll fanfare, Donald Trump. So I'm just wondering if in fact Trump gets elected, as I think he's going to do, I think that may very well diminish any possibilities of the Starostenkos giving any sort of rectitude or rectification for their claims, because it just and forgive me for waxing lengthy here, Lucy, but between Donald Trump's election and his inauguration, I did a five-part radio series called The Making of Donald Trump, subtitled Top Banana Republic. And this was based on a very short, very incisive book by David K. Johnston called The Making of Donald Trump. And if he becomes president, he literally has never done anything honest or forthright in his entire life. And with him having purchased part of Resorts International, My guess is that the Bahamas will become even more self-consciously or confidently corrupt epicenter than it already is, and it already is plenty corrupt. Again, I find it very interesting, Lucy, that the people who were sticking it to the Starostinkos would not allow you, just as an observer, to chronicle what was going on past the point. Maybe you've already addressed this. What is your view as to why they wouldn't allow you to look at this?
It was really pointless because I have all of the story without looking at a hearing, which is really just about, procedural motions. It's just part of their mindset, which is pretty nasty. But they obviously they don't really have a problem. This story was published in Inside Parodoplots, as you indicated, the Postille, which is out of Toronto. On the Commissar Scoop, my website, it was sent to dozens of US publications, both corporate and so-called alternative. Nobody had the guts to run a story which is against the largest private banking institution in the world. Nobody. So they hardly even have to worry. It's not as if journalists are banging on their doors asking to watch the hearings or trying to do the story. Other journalists are not. I'm the only one that is doing this. So it's almost unnecessary for them to do it, and it's really rather stupid. It just makes them look bad, as if they didn't look very bad to begin with. But it's just another example of how these people see themselves in the world, which is they should be controlling everything.
Well, indeed, one of the robber barons observed, but we'll see, that during or immediately after the Great Depression, and he said during a recession, which was the euphemism they always used, money returns to its rightful owners, which is a remarkably cynical dynamic to adhere to. One of the things that perhaps Lucy, I think, encompasses. Well, encapsulates would be a better word. Everything you've spoken about, and that again, perhaps maybe I'm projecting here, but the photograph of Jonathan Humphreys III, I've already alluded to this. If that gentleman doesn't have what might be euphemized as a fresh fertilizer eating smile, I don't know what is. When you see someone smiling like that, you know they're doing something wrong. Normal people don't smile like that. I mean, perhaps, that strictly me saying that, but it
Well,
really is.
it's a silly picture. It was a photograph, and I took it off. I think I took it off Twitter. But the real problem with him is that he refuses to talk. If you're defending a company, you should be able to say ABC, and this is wrong, and that's right, and let me explain to you what really went on. They refuse to say anything, anything. And which basic and I sent him the whole article. And by the way, I have not heard a peep. Usually, if you write something that's wrong, and one of the reasons you send it to them is you don't want to have anything wrong. You don't want to defame anybody. You want to be totally correct. If they found something wrong, I would change it, of course. But there has not been. This came out in August on the Commissar Scoop and on and the other publications. August. It's a couple of months. There has not been a peep from them, not a peep that said anything in that story is wrong. But I'm very confident in what I've said, and I hope, and I have put some of this stuff on Twitter. By the way, my Twitter is at Lucy Commissar, and the website is thecommissarscoop.com, and I hope people will look at that because there are a lot of links to documents because everything I said was documented, which is obviously is the reason that they have not come back at me to say, our lawyers will call you. The lawyers can't possibly. That would be wonderful, actually, to be in court with them. That would be the only trial on the merits there has been. If they don't want to give a trial on the merits in the Bahamas, they obviously don't want to give a trial on the merits anyplace else. But he's a flunky. I mean, yes, he really looks foolish. I don't know if I how he could possibly put up that picture. Maybe it's the best one he had. He's a flunky, and but that's his job. His job is basically to get you on. He actually called me because using LinkedIn, I sent a message to the CEO of the U.S. company, and also the chief press person for the U.S. company. And I got a call back from this guy saying, "Nothing we say can be on the record." And then he went on and said nothing, which was pretty funny. Nothing that he said could. And we also had some email conversation. Nothing is on the record. I mean, nothing. Well, how could I repeat what he said when all he said was nothing is on the record? That's basically what he said. So they could not defend themselves. There's nothing that that helps a reporter more to know that she's got it right is when the person that she's writing about, the criminality of the criminals that she's writing about, cannot say one thing to prove that anything she said is wrong. So I.
And this is Jonathan Humphreys, is the media director for UBS Global Wealth Management Americas. Lucy, tell us about Maureen Hassan, that's first name capital Maureen, last name capital Hassan. Who was she? With what institutions was she connected? I also have some thoughts well, who was Maureen Hassan?
Well, she had been first vice president and chief operating officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And she was an alternate voting member of the Federal Open Market Committee, which is very powerful in the US financial system. They make decisions about things like interest. And then she had become the president of America's hyphen or UBS. But she's gone now. They moved her out and put someone else in. But she never responded to me. The word just went down to Humphreys, because she obviously had nothing to say also. I mean, if you have a very solid story with evidence about how your company is ripping off clients in the Bahamas in this case, what can you say? And that was the, but you always have to send. I sent a draft of the article to her and also to the head of media relations for America's UBS. And they could not respond other than to have Jonathan Humphreys give me a call. And it basically is a confirmation that everything I said is correct.
The fact that the name is Inside Parada Plots, the financial publication from Zurich, had your article. I think the people involved here, and I think I don't think it's out of line to call them malefactors. They know now that someone else knows, someone who is significant. And I suspect that is driving at least some of their clandestineness.
Well, yes, Inside Parade Plots is read by all the bankers in Zurich. Everybody, there were a huge number of comments on the story. Everybody in Zurich reads that because they put in all kinds of inside stuff, and it's very reliable. The editor, Lucas Hasig, is very prominent as journalist. So it was very important that this story be published there. And this my story. It's they publish it in English. My story on my website links to that story on Inside Parade Plots.
It's remarkable. So, are you in the position to detail for some of the reaction? Or just it's fascinating to me to see what appears to me to be a more or less openly criminal undertaking by elements of UBS. And yet, so far, with not only impunity, but with a degree of institutional arrogance that is shocking, and I think would be shocking to many people. who feel that the quote system unquote works unquote. And again, bringing to mind the comments of the late best-selling Seebane that the world is run by banksters. Have you had any direct comments from your Parada Plots article or any direct feedback?
Not direct to me, and I just glanced at that. I didn't have time to read all of the comments there. Some people liked it, some people didn't like it, but I have not had other reactions.
Reading to give people an idea of the unfolding of these procedures. Again, reading from your article, Lucy. Looking at the document, she said that that's Irina. UBS AB Zurich is the custodian. They don't appear to reveal the broker dealer unless those first three symbols before UBS AB Zurich is the broker. The column header indicates broker custodian, unquote, for that line. This also indicates, or this is symptomatic of my own lack of understanding of the fundamentals of these kinds of transactions, because it's difficult for me to pass the point, understand this. I have to be very pedantic and go through this to keep it all in front of my eyes. Again, quoting from your article and Ms. Tsareva, she said, quote, "The document handler is UBS Wealth Management. The document indicates that the shares were won held by UBS AB Zurich as custodian, probably after receiving them from the broker, since the $28.75 commission shows there." Then two moved to
Well, let me
jokingly.
interrupt. Let me interrupt. This is not from Irina Tsareva. This is from Dr. Suzanne Trimbath, who's an expert who worked for the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, DTCC, which is the U.S. National Clearing
Oh,
Agency. She's a
yep.
consultant on stock settlement and the author of several books on the stock market. I showed her the various so-called confirmations that were sent by UBS, and she analyzed them. And that's what she's saying. She's looking in this case, this particular page, and talking about the document, and saying the document doesn't show the broker dealer, because it shows other things, but it was that the UBS AG Zurich was the custodian of it. Then they moved it to the company, which was the Starostenkos, and so on and so on. She's analyzing everything on the document, which is supposedly confirmation, and shows that it's not a confirmation.
And going back to the article here, she, meaning Ms. Trimbath, she said the document header is UBS Wealth Management. The document indicates that the shares were won held by UBS AG Zurich as custodian, probably after receiving them from the broker, since the $28.75 commission shows there. Then two moved to Junkanoo Estates Limited, the Starostenko's company. Irina Tsareva said they chose the name of a Caribbean folk festival they witnessed on their arrival to pay tribute to the Bahamas. The second section is the same as the first, with the exception of the addition of the $1,437.34 UBS commission. The final message confirms that $28.75 was the broker's fee. The UBS fee would be an advisory fee. And then quoting Ms. Trimbath, quote, "So to me, it says the trade was done on New York Stock Exchange, but by, quote, another broker dealer," unquote. And I'm going to ask you to explain what that would mean, because again, my own lack of understanding of the fundamentals of these things. If
Well,
UBS Wealth Management trades as principal, it doesn't go to an exchange, but takes shares from their own inventory. She concluded, quote, "None of the documents say that UBS Financial Services executed the trades on the New York Stock Exchange. Even the internal documents only show UBS AG was the agent, not the broker." And I don't understand. Well, I don't understand how these transactions would work, and how that What should have been done as opposed to what was done. Can you develop that for us, Lucy? I mean, I just my own lack of understanding of the fundamentals of these kinds of transactions here is front and center. So if you could perhaps clear up some of my ignorance about this.
Well, there were two ways, as she indicated, to buy shares. Very big companies like UBS or Goldman Sachs or Citi or JP Morgan, they have so many stocks in their own inventory from their clients that when one client, in this case, a client of UBS in the Bahamas, wants to buy a share, they can just get it from some other client who, by the way, wants to sell a share. They're so big, they don't even have to go to the exchange like of NYSE. But if they go to NYSE, they have to get this confirmation. But if they're just doing it internally, they also have to send some kind of confirmation. And based on what she says, that the document doesn't show anything like that. And because she said that document said the trade was done on NYSE, but by another broker dealer. So it wasn't being done by UBS Wealth Management as a principal and taking shares from its own inventory from other clients. It says, from what she read, the trade was done by another broker dealer. So there should have been a confirmation and from that broker dealer, which is not mentioned, and it never happened.
It's just stunning to me. Again, most people, and I think to an extent myself as well, even though I probably should know better after I'm in my 46th year on the air, we have a tendency to think that, well, there is a bottom line, and that when you're dealing with large financial institutions, your money is safe, the transactions are safe. There is a degree of operational integrity to this. And what's really apparent here is that that is not the case. And then you sum up into a reprise. Here are the claimed, quote, confirmation, unquote, documents UBS provided. One, on October 2nd, 2013, UBS provided a list of 204 trades dated September 19th, 2013, for the trades executed on June through September of 2013, which it called trade confirmations, no mention of brokers. On February 28th, 2014, the Starostenkos received 205 sheets delivered by George Malis, capital MAILLIS, for trades from June 13th, 2013 to September 18th, 2013. It included 199 trade advisors, totaling 205 pages, no mention of brokers outside the Bahamas. On October 2nd, 2018, they received a document dated August 30th, 2018, items 18 through 101, a list of internal trade confirmations, not confirmation documents. No mention of brokers outside the Bahamas. On November 7th, 2018, they got a UBS account statement with 51, quote, contract notes, unquote, and related 51, quote, securities trade contracts, unquote, documents the bank created, 121 pages. It mentioned UBS Bahamas, UBS Wealth Management, and UBS AG Zurich. No broker in the U.S. Irina Sarita said, quote, why? Out of 204, are there only 51 contract notes slash trial contracts? And most of them are buys. Where are the sells and the rest of the trades? Well, indeed. And then continue here. On December 13th, 2018, they got a UBS December 31st, 2013 account statement for December 31st, 2013, containing listings of 205 cash transactions and 202 security transactions. It shows two dates for each trade, alleging that the second date is the date of settlement. No mention of any brokers. And, you go on to comment. At a hearing on February 21st, 2019, UBS tried to persuade the judge that trading advisors are regular documents for trading in New York Stock Exchange, following the Starostenko's insistence that the papers UBS had provided were not confirmations, and after UBS's attorney said they produced all in their client's possession and had no other documents, Judge Ian R. Winder said, quote, I will make the order that your client produce an affidavit in the very terms that you're representing to me now, unquote. He ordered UBS to swear an affidavit that it did not have other documents. And then you say, then the Starostenko's got a smoking gun. After years of legal wranglings and the court affidavit, a UBS executive confirmed that after extensive searches, excuse me, no trade confirmations from U.S. brokers could be located. I love the passive voice there. No trade confirmations from U.S. brokers could be located. You know, I mean, it's just, hello, you know, that seems, well, we can't locate them, you know. And, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I mean, it looks to me as if they just flat out are lying and scamming here. That is my opinion. And
Well,
again, that's all.
they didn't have trade confirmations. They had lots of internal documents, but none of them mentioned any brokers. And the trade in the Bahamas, the UBS Bahamas, cannot trade into the New York Stock Exchange. Only it's not a member. Only member organizations can trade into the New York Stock Exchange. Well, there are some UBS member organizations, but they did not provide any trade confirmations. No. There was no American broker, no member of the NYSE that provided any trade confirmations. That tells me there were no trade confirmations. That tells me there were no trades. That it was all a scam. These are fictitious trades. And of course, they should have been immediately shut down by the Securities Commission that in the Bahamas. And there should be action taken by the SEC in the US if trades are if, this is a scam on the US because this changes the market. If people are tr really trading in the market, that will make the market for shares that share go up and down, right? Suppose that person or that group of people or company is thinks they're trading in the market. But they're not trading in the market because their broker in the Bahamas never sent the trades there. That all changes the market, the American market. It scams the American market. And also, what about the whoever should have been, if suppose they're buying shares, somebody is selling shares and getting money. Well, if they're not really buying shares, whoever might be selling shares is not getting any money from them because there's no real trade. So all of these people who are in the trade in the US on the other side of their trade, they're losing. They're also being scammed. Why isn't the SEC dealing with this? It's changing the market. It's distorting the market because you don't have buys and sells that would normally make the market change. And other people who are traders are being scammed because they're losing money. They're not selling. These people want to buy shares. Somebody is losing out because they are not selling the share because there's nobody really buying them. Why isn't the SEC in Washington concerned about this? The Starostenkos have sent complaints to the SEC explaining everything that's been happening. They've never even gotten a response.
Again, I don't think of myself as either stupid or ignorant, and yet, on a personal note, Lucy, I find your article, it's not only wrote a very, very excellent article, but it really humbles me because I just have a difficult time not having engaged in any of these transactions, nor do I have the academic background to make critical analysis of this. The reading your article makes my eyes cross, and I want to apologize if I have not done it justice. But one of the things that I think is so important about your article is maybe its very existence and what it shows about the system. And again, I think in terms of the long time, and I'm in my 46th year on air, this will be a Patreon talk, and also on your Zoom and YouTube channels, so you can use this. But the aforementioned programs for the record 1149 of 1150, and also the series about darkness in the vaults. You know, when the corridors of power and the corridors of big finance, capital with a capital B and the capital F, maneuver, and when they hook up and they're inextricably linked. Again, I think a lot of people, including at times myself, we think, well, there's a bottom line. You know, in the end, it's going to be okay. And I think what your article indicates is that there is no bottom line, and that really any confidence, and maybe forgive me if you think I'm putting words in your mouth, Lucy, here, but don't feel free to correct me. But anyone who has any confidence in the system and feels that, well, it will be all right, really needs to rethink their position.
Well, that's true. The people who win in trading are the big institutions, the hedge funds, and the banks who are doing the trading. The little people pretty much always lose. Advisors will accept the people who run the brokerages. Advisors will tell people just join one of these, like Vanguard or one of these firms where you go into them and they have lots of shares and they buy and sell and you're not doing it and you do much better with one of those kinds of companies and not buying and selling shares by yourself. So I think you're less likely to get cheated if you go into one of the big firms and you're just buying a share of many kinds of stocks. You're not just buying one share of one stock and selling it. So that's the first advice that consumer-friendly advisors on the stock market will always say, don't buy and sell shares unless you're a real expert. But because I think the system really is very corrupt, it's not that everybody is cheated all the time, but you have to know that the UBS has repeatedly been found to be corrupt, feloniously corrupt, had to send in billions of dollars of fines. And so we know that that company has a history of corruption. Anybody that gets an account with UBS has been warned. And there are some other companies that also are known to be very corrupt that just check about the companies, the stock trading companies that have years of felony convictions in the US courts. And there are others besides UBS. And so you stand warned. And I don't know. I don't buy individual shares. First of all, as a journalist, I would never buy shares or deal with one of these kinds of companies because I'm writing about them. So I have never bought these shares. But I would recommend that people be very careful about dealing with companies who have histories of corruption, published, known histories of corruption.
Indeed. Lucy, is there anything that you think should be discussed with regard to your article that I have not brought up? And feel free if you think I've blown it in any particular area. Don't hesitate to add that in, because again, as I've indicated, I'm to an extent in awe of your article and the expertise that you bring to it, because it just, that so much of this makes my eyes cross. Nonetheless, though, I think it's very important. And in a sense, what your article does is to present in microcosm what I have in some of the programs and in some of the books that are available for download for free on my website. I tried to present perhaps in macrocosm. Is there anything that you think I have not covered, Lucy, or that needs
No,
to be discussed?
you have covered everything. And I want to say that this is written for an ordinary person. It is not written for an expert or somebody whose job is in the financial services or stock markets. It's very clearly written without jargon and with a lot of explanation. And the documents are there just so you can take a look and see what does this fake confirmation, the so-called confirmation, look like. But basically, it's written with lots of color and quotes and made very easy for people. So people should not be frightened about taking a look at this, which you'll find on my website. But I think you've covered everything, and let's see if anything else develops. Maybe something, maybe some agency actually could take a look at this, and maybe there'll be a second chapter to this one. You never know.
Well, the thing about viewers is I'm gonna write a food for thought post for my website about your article, and hopefully call a little bit more attention to it. And when I look at this stuff, it makes my eyes cross. That is not meant as a knock on your article, but rather, it is symptomatic of my own lack of understanding of these kinds of deals and financial maneuvers. I just, it's a long way from home for a wage slave and day job worker. So it is quite remarkable. Once again, the name of the article is Editors Global Bank UBS Scammed Clients in Fictitious Trades to U.S. Markets, and it's by our guest Lucy Kumisar, August 10th, 2024, and it was featured in Inside Parabola Plots, the perhaps the Bailey financial publication of record for the banking community in Zurich, and that was edited or run by Lucas Hossig, Hausig, and it is a remarkable story. We have got only, as far as I can tell, one other direct participant in this talk. That's Garfield. Normally, these Zoom talks, we have other participants as well, but whatever the thing is that's interfering. Garfield, did you have any questions or comments that you wanted to direct to Lucy? And I see you've got your mic muted here. Garfield, are you there? Anyway, no, apparently not. So Lucy,
Hey,
we've got
sorry.
Garfield, there you are. Did you have any questions you wanted to direct to Lucy
Oh,
or
sorry, this
comments?
is David. No, I don't. Off the top of my head.
Oh, maybe. How about Garfield? He's still got his mic. Now, Garfield, is there anything you wanted to ask Lucy or comment on?
No, because I think I've got too many questions. I just don't have anything that is concise and detailed to the point to where it wouldn't end up becoming a rambling as I'm doing now. So I just w will say I am a very appreciative of the work that she has put forward on your broadcast over the years, and I have watched her website on occasion. It's great work, and I'd like to be more involved. I actually can't move forward with any pertinent questions at this time.
It's a brilliant article. And by the way, Lucy, although it's not necessarily directly related to your article, one of the stations at which I work, periodically they have what they call the female takeover. And what that is, every so often, they have nothing but female DJs and nothing but female CDs or performers. I have 2 1-hour slots on that station each week from 6 to 7. And so what I did was, you are a former deputy director of the National Organization of Women, are you not?
No, I'm a former national vice president of the National Organization for Women.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, Vice President. I'm sorry, wrong title. But yes, so I said, well, obviously I'm not female, but it would be great if you're having the female takeover to have someone who is not who not only wields tremendous expertise, but someone whose feminine and feminist credentials are unimpeachable. And so and the people who were directing the female takeover just loved the shows that we did. I think we did three of those. So that was remarkable. And again, I want to, for the people that will eventually listen to this, I want to encourage them to extrapolate from this article to some of the other larger institutional corruption that I have documented in other programs and other Patreon posts. So, Lucy, if there's anything else that you would like to comment on or introduce into the discussion, now is the time.
No,
Okay.
we said
Well,
everything.
very good. And I'll send you some of the questions and the B questions and bullet points that I've discussed in connection with the article.
Okay.
Very good. Well, thank you so much, Lucy.
You're welcome. My pleasure. Bye.
Very good. Bye-bye now. And that wraps things up for this Zoom meeting. I guess I could take Garfield's question if he wants to, but he might, we know how to communicate. So I think what we'll do is we'll wrap this up. And Babe, I will send you a blurb to put up about this talk. Very good.
Okay, that's it, I guess.